So Doug and Ryan back. What's this called? Yeah, the steering committee. And sorry, it's been a long week.
It's been a long week. We'll give you that one.
Sick kids and busy jobs. But
yeah, as we said before, we both have other day jobs that we have quite a high demand.
Yeah, you might be shocked to hear that this doesn't pay the bills, but
not yet.
Although I hear we have some sponsors now, which is interesting, or at least the podcast.
Like Regis University.
Yeah, that was one of them. So
Regis University.
That's cool. What's the other one I always hear? Audible.com, I'm sure will be next. And
we're just around the corner from all that.
So busy. Been doing some interesting things, and I had an opportunity to go to an interesting place this morning, thanks to my 7-year-old daughter. She apparently is a classmate with the daughter of a fellow by the name of Blake Scholl, who is the CEO, I think the founder of a company here in town called Boom Supersonic, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know a whole lot about the airplane world, and I bring this up only because there are a lot of technology, you know, parallels with the car world. But basically,
we both decided we're kind of like amateur sort of like
it's something that interests me and this is a company, as I understand it, and if anyone listening is can correct me, please do, but basically they're trying to bring back supersonic passenger air travel, which is interesting. And I think they have a goal of basically, you know, what the Concorde was doing back in the day, but at a friendlier price. It's still more than what regular air travel would be. But, you know, I think they're cutting the flight time in half or less than half. So really interesting. I guess they're kind of a startup or whatever, but they've got a prototype or a sort of proof of concept that they're coming out with soon, as I understand it. And then the goal would be to produce an airplane that's sold to major airlines but
are they trying to build like passenger?
That would be the ultimate
size,
I think they'd be like the Concorde. I don't know if it has to do with the just the mechanics or the physics of supersonic air travel, but the planes are much narrower. Mm-hmm. So I think the planes are sort of a 1x1 seating position, or at least that's what they have in mind. And I want to say that the Concorde was a 2x1. I remember my grandparents flying on it a handful of times. And
jet setters.
I'm sure there was some catch, but it was. I just remember they had a little model of the thing, and I seem to remember it being a 2x1 seating. What do you want to call that, map or whatever, but I could be wrong. But
we'll take a look. We got what I'm looking at here is it's two rows of two seats.
So it was actually 2x2. Okay, so this would be a smaller plane, but compared to say like a 777 or something, these are quite a bit
narrower. Not wide bodies.
It was interesting. I learned a lot today. Apparently these airplanes, the wings are smaller than sort of a traditional airliner. So I guess that's for drag at high speeds, and they don't need these big, when they're traveling that quickly, right? You don't need the big wings, but then the trade-off is you need a longer runway, things like that. Mm-hmm. Pretty interesting.
And you're saying that they're mostly constructed out of carbon fiber.
I don't think, I don't think I'm giving away any secrets here or anything. There were no restrictions on we'd have to sign anything or turn off our phones. No, apparently, as I was told, all the secret stuff is in another room. But pretty cool place. And the facility had everything from, research and development to design to actual manufacturing. Their unique selling position ever is that these things are composite, right? They're carbon fiber. And they even gave the kids a demonstration on how they form, the carbon fiber with the fiber pieces. And, apparently each one of these threads is a fraction of the width of your hair on your head. And they use this binding agent. They cook it. It was pretty interesting. And of course, with carbon fiber being used so more and more in cars, it was interesting. Mm-hmm. And I guess you know, they, ultimately the goal would be to have this commercial air travel, I think, at about a third or a quarter of the cost of, say, what this would have cost in today's dollars with something like the Concorde. Pretty interesting stuff. Yeah. A lot of smart people. Cool. Seemed like a really cool place to work.
Yeah.
Appreciate their generosity in showing us around. And fascinating stuff. And
Were we able to see? Did they have their concept like available to view? Or?
They have the fuselage was, if I remember correctly, was there, and they have a big oven that they bring down and cook the thing, and lots of renderings. Of course, it sounds like they're on track, and they had a simulator that you could fly, and of course there's another dad in the group who just happened to be a former military pilot, so he was able to get on the simulator and show us how it was show us all how it was done. But interesting stuff, and it's just kind of made me feel like, okay, my day job's a little boring when these people are doing this level of
compared to that almost every job.
Know, not quite rocket scientists, but I guess pretty close. Yeah. So anyway, shout out to Boom Supersonic, rather.
Also, shout out guys to my brother-in-law, Pat, who actually is a rocket scientist.
Oh, well,
I think this job actually sounds more exciting to that.
He does not have a car podcast.
He does not, and so, we'll see if he even listens to this. So there you are, Pat.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and a nod to our joke about he also did not go to art school, but...
yeah. he did not go to art school.
If we have a running joke, that's it, but...
Yeah.
Anyway.
The pathway to Porsche ownership.
That's apparent.
Tell your mom and dad, go to art school if you want
to. In student loan debt, but what isn't, right? Yeah. No, all good, and it was a lot of fun, and I was just impressed with the whole operation, and I was also impressed when they were showing us some examples of things they had produced, and I don't know if this one was from a three-dimensional printer or it was carbon fiber, but they had output a car, and they held it up and they asked the kids, these are mostly 7, 8, 9-year-old kids, what is this? And I think they were looking for the answer, a car. And I heard it, Lamborghini, Huracan. So.
And was that right?
It was correct. Like, so yeah. Truth be told, I couldn't quite tell that it was an Huracan or an Aventador from where I was sitting. So kudos to whoever.
So a young version of ourselves was in.
That's right. Which is pretty cool.
No, that wasn't your daughter that said
it. It was not. She reminded me today, I don't like cars, which has not always been the case, but I think she gets so tired of me talking about them all the time. So she did tell me though today that she wants to do a YouTube channel, and she wants to travel and explore abandoned buildings and ghost towns and turn that into a YouTube channel. I know these channels are out there, a lot of them, but I don't know that any of them are hosted by a 7-year-old. So
no.
So we'll see.
Not gonna lie, in general, that's a good idea. I'd watch that.
Hey, and all I'm thinking is, how can we monetize this? You know,
how can we monetize your 7-year-old daughter?
Yeah. Well, that's
But we'll circle back on that. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, I just meant that's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
I'd watch someone walking through old abandoned
buildings. No, it'd be cool. Of course, I'd be the one that would have to take her there and try to prevent her from falling through, you know, rotted floors and all that. But anyway, but it was really interesting to hear about the carbon fiber and the composites and how it's all made, and it seems sort of simple when someone else is showing you, but I know there's a lot more that goes into it, and I was also really interested to find out that they are not just using 3-dimensional printing to prototype pieces and elements of the plane, but they're actually incorporating those 3-dimensionally printed pieces. I mean, they're outputting them for use, which was, I didn't realize that was a thing. So
like they're using like a 3D printer to actually produce carbon fiber components.
I don't know if they were carbon fiber or some sort of plastic, thermoplastic or something, but enough to, you know, to go into a.
But not just for
for really interesting,
like, as actual components.
That's
interesting. So,
apparently they have the largest 3-dimensional printer you can have. It's something from Germany or something. So anyway, very, very cool. Again,
how big was it? Like, what can
you... it's about the size of a...
Let me ask you this. How big of components can it make?
You know, something I would say, well, they may be bigger, but I was shown something to me that looked like a manifold from a car, a small manifold from a car.
Oh, okay.
So, interesting. And you, yeah. it's a lot of smart people out there, and I'll leave it at that, but appreciate being able to see the facility. And
that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if people know this or not, but there is a fairly robust aeronautical aerospace economy here in Colorado.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of people obviously think, like, Seattle, and they think, mm-hmm. like, maybe California, you know, Los Angeles area, you know, is traditional, you know, hubs for that type yeah. of stuff, and even Wichita, where...
That's right, yeah.
Was that Learjet was based out of there, I think?
I think so, yeah.
But in reality, there's actually a lot of high-tech aerospace companies based out of Colorado. That's right. So,
is it Recaro owned by Learjet, or there's some sort of connection, or maybe that's how they came to be?
The seat makers?
The seat company. I think that Recaro is actually out of Michigan, but I always thought there was some sort of connection. Like,
I don't know,
but...
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's, of course, we've got the connection with the Air Force Academy, which we've talked about earlier. Like,
yeah, you know, a lot of military in general.
Yeah, so anyway, pretty good stuff. And again, I don't think I'm giving away any secrets, but a neat facility. And I have sort of a different appreciation really for carbon fiber, and that goes into it. And when you actually see, you know, a carbon fiber part, or you can hold a carbon fiber part in one hand and even an aluminum part, you know, equivalent in the other hand, you realize, you know, how rigid and how lightweight this stuff is. So, anyway.
It is remarkable. And it's, like, you know, when it's used, it's like the immediate, you know, performance benefits are apparent. I mean, lighter, stronger.
Yeah.
You know, all those things.
Yeah.
Cost of production is really the only prohibitive thing.
Yeah.
That's come down so much from, like, I mean, I recall, like, and I guess this is something that what drove, what is it, Horatio Pagani nuts, because mm-hmm. he was a young engineer at Lamborghini, is that they had one of the first car companies to experiment with carbon fiber. They had the loom, they had the facilities.
Really?
They built a whole prototype Countach, I guess, out of carbon fiber, and immediately saw the potential
for
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, whatever, they were probably going through one of their financial crises, and they put it down, And he left and soon, you know, formed his own company. And, you know, the Paganis are all, I think those are mostly carbon fiber.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
and
it's...
Now it's, you know, now Lamborghini's kind of behind on all that stuff.
Yeah, so. No, and I felt the whole time we were at this place, like, you know, they were, you know, they're probably going to blow up isn't the word, but, or the phrase, but I really see a potential in this. It seems like it makes so much sense and the timing is right and they have a great product and... it's interesting.
Well, like,
it's just nice to see that innovation.
It's supersonic flight. Yeah, I mean, so it's technically, it's, you know, it's been around for a long time, and then, you know, it was applied for commercial. I mean, the Concorde flew in the 70s, right?
Yeah, you know, but that was steel and aluminum, and
right, and it seemed like it was just this one sort of novelty thing that they had. They couldn't, I guess they couldn't get permission to fly over land because the sonic boom was disrupted.
Is that right?
That's what I understood. Or I don't know if they just couldn't get permission, or if it wasn't allowed or what, but, like, you know, they'd have this, you know, sonic boom issue flying over
land.
So that's why it basically fell down to just, like, you know, the cross-Atlantic flights.
Yeah, and I think they just never put, I think it was an international consortium, government was involved, I'm sure there were some subsidies. Yeah. And then, of course, there was a tragedy
at
the end that I don't remember. But, you know, they were just, they've been flying for, I think, you know, 40 or 50 years at that point. And so.
Yeah, it was a joint venture between, I think, British Aerospace and whatever the French.
Yeah, the French consortium or whatever.
Yeah, so, British Airways and, you know, whatever the French version of that had they were the only two airlines, I think, using them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I recall, like, back in the day, it was like a $10,000 flight.
Well, I heard today it was $21,000 in today's money. So.
Oh yeah, I could believe that.
Yeah, yeah.
When I'm thinking about that, that's back in, like, the late '80s, early
'90s, right?
Which was significantly more expensive.
I mean, that's a lot of dough for 4 or 5 hours or whatever the flight was, right? Well, or was it even that?
I mean, you know, from a business, if you're thinking about it from a cost effectiveness, you must be thinking, like, you know, whatever. So what's a regular flight across the Atlantic? About 9 hours?
I think about that, yeah. 7, 8 hours, I guess, maybe, depending on where you go. From Denver to London, I bet it's 9 hours or 10 hours, right?
I don't know, but I mean, the thing is, so it's only flying from, it's like basically flying from New York to, like, London, or or New York to, like, Paris or something. So whatever, you know, time you save there, you have to figure out if that's worth
Yeah.
About $9,000, yeah. or $15,000 compared to like a regular ticket, right?
Pretty confident in saying that I'll never have a job where I'm so important and my money's worth so much that I'm financial sense.
Four hours difference is like $15,000 burnt up.
Yeah. Well, but you know, it's a neat thing to think about, and hopefully someday I'll get to ride in one of these when they inevitably bring them to market. But you know, I thought it'd be interesting to just take a peek at what was in the parking lot just to see what these engineers and all drove.
Yeah.
I will say Boom Supersonic employees got to up the cars a little bit.
Yeah.
I did see a couple Porsches in the parking lot.
Inspiration as you get to work.
That's right. Or maybe cars just don't compare, right? If you're a test pilot on something like that. But
I guess. But pilots in general are known for having fun cars.
You think, right?
I mean, fighter pilots usually are.
Yeah.
So you said, so some of the better things you saw?
There was a Cayman, a first or second gen Cayman. It was probably a 987.1 or 2. There was a 996 Carrera Silver one.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of Teslas and things, but I don't know what I was expecting, but a lot full of McLaren F1s.
I was going to say, until their IPO goes public, you're not going to see any cars built out of carbon fiber.
I suppose not. Yeah. That got me thinking too. You know, that's something that is anyone really doing? You just mentioned Pagani, and there's some race cars or some, you know, there's some full, you know, even Porsche. I mean, there's not a mainstream carbon bodied model available. Mm-hmm. The only ones would be, you know, some race cars right. I mean, what else is out there?
See a lot of carbon hoods. What was the carbon fiber components in the Carrera GT?
Did it have a carbon frame?
I don't know, but. And then what would be the 918 or what was the hybrid then?
Yeah, the 918. But I imagine we'll see, you know, they mentioned too, it's not just these supersonic planes that are getting the, you know, the carbon fiber construction or whatever that, you know, I guess the new Boeing plane or whatever that came out.
Dreamliner. I know Dreamliner uses a lot of carbon fiber to try and save weight and make their engines more efficient, you know, by carrying less weight, so.
And so much of it is the weight, right, and the fuel burned.
I think that's what they're trying. So with these guys, if obviously they're trying to do supersonic flight, they're going to be running engines, burning more fuel as a result. So by any efficiency they can gain by making it lighter would be a benefit.
Right.
So.
But it's interesting, right, because you're burning more fuel in the moment, but over a shorter length of time. So many variables, things to think about. It's good stuff, and the kids really enjoyed seeing it all, too. But... So yeah, you and I maybe should start a carbon fiber.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what's gotten me thinking though is like, I think there could be like a market for like carbon fiber, like being able to print out carbon fiber like interior parts and you know, like replace some of your dated old plastic.
Yeah.
Something nicer, you know?
It seems to me, and I could be way off on this, but from what I gleaned today,
mm-hmm.
that by its nature, carbon fiber would not be something that you could 3D print.
Mm-hmm.
That 3D printing has to do with building up material.
It's like they kind of like add like a layer of stuff.
Right, and carbon fiber by its nature.
Maybe not
is
carbon
more
fiber, that's wrong. But even if they could like we've noticed, like you can definitely notice on some cars like have good plastic or bad plastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And like being able to upgrade to nicer plastic or this polymer type thing,
right.
I think that would be, because that's like one thing that like separates frankly, like cars that I've always liked, like my Subaru WRXs and my, you know, BRZs from like the Porsches of the world, you know, they both use plastic on the inside.
Yeah.
There's a much higher quality on the Porsche.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
and there's no way to upgrade the plastics right now.
You could probably get a nice wood grain package if you wanted, but.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, I don't know. It's just a wood grain package on my WRX. That'd be hot.
They're out there. Yeah.
Trim panel pieces for the
Well, and this is the. I know we talk way too much about Porsches and especially 718s just because we've got one handy here, but.
I like that you said that we have one.
Right? Well,
can I take it home tonight? Is it?
No, you may not.
No. Well, but, worth a try. Yeah. You have a 718.
But I would.
There is a distinct difference between the plastics used on a Porsche, or on a, you know, any higher market car, Mercedes.
No, right. But I was, what I was going to say, not that the plastic in my Cayman is so wonderful. In fact, I would argue that I think there's probably a difference between in the plastic, you know, in a Cayman versus a, you know, a 911 even.
That's fair.
I'd have to check that.
But I mean, your car doesn't look low rent, is my point.
I am getting by with those 19-inch wheels.
Oh yeah,
but
well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
anyway, not really car related, but kind of car related, and a pretty cool experience.
I think that's interesting. Company, you know, we're not. I mean, we're not just, you know, single minded here. We have
no interests.
Delve into that. So we might, from time to time, drop these things in here to just to talk and kind of like a palate change,
a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that. All right, we'll come back. We'll talk about cars. How about that?
We're back, and Ryan has brought to my attention, I missed this week, although I feel like I was watching a lot of auctions.
How'd you miss something and bring a trailer?
I usually...
BAT Sentinel.
You know, I like my routine. I get to work, I pop open my computer, I go right to bring a trailer, I open up all the auctions that are closing.
You work for
day.
Yourself.
Maybe that's part of my problem. And I open up all the auctions that are closing that day, and I click on like the whatever I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Some days it's like 3, and some days it's like 9. Yeah. But I missed this
one. Have you ever bid on a car and bring a trailer?
No.
I haven't either. And
I made some, I've commented occasionally.
No, I've commented for better or worse, but apparently they put quite a hold on your credit card, and that's the only reason I haven't.
Oh, yeah.
At least I'm not one of those guys bidding, you know, $1,996 on a 96, you know,
oh, well, there's
Porsche that's...
Well, you know, I have... I mean, or
what's the point of this?
What's your take? Hold on. Yeah, we're going down a rabbit hole here, but what's your take on the guys who, like, when a 997 Porsche... jumps up there and someone goes up and bids $997. What's your take on that?
I think it's so they in the later than go in the comments and try to put someone down and say, well, you've never even bid on anything. And you know, I've been on 100 cars, you know. I mean, I think that's what that is. There are some real douchebags in the bring a trailer comments.
It's a jungle.
So to
bring it back, I missed this somehow, but there was a couple days ago, a 1971 Datsun 240Z Series 1 that was in...
Hubcaps and everything.
Yeah, it's got the hubcaps and the decals on the side and everything. No louvers on the back glass.
Though, no, this is for a pre-louver.
Maybe that could have bumped the value up a little bit more.
Yeah.
I wonder if they were a little disappointed with the $310,000 winning.
Yeah, shout out, hat tip to my esteemed friend Ben Schmidt in the Chicago area, who's got quite the fleet himself. Even he thought this was outrageous.
Yeah. It is, right?
It's
got a set of records.
You mentioned the louvers, and I always think of louvers as sort of the mullet of the car accessory world, right? And kind of, you know, before louvers and after louvers, right? And this was, what year is this exactly?
71.
The 71, so just before, right? And honestly, this car looks like it's an earlier car even, right? It's got the lines of something even earlier than 71. You know, and on the surface, I mean, you know, this doesn't maybe seem so outrageous. Cars are, you know, certain cars have increased hugely in recent years, as evidenced by the Porsches and all that. But I think what's bothering everyone about this one, and I think what my friend Ben was getting at, is that, at $310,000, this is 3 times the sale price of the next equivalent model on Bring a Trailer. I don't know much about these cars. I don't think you do either. Datsun's, Nissan's not really in my realm.
No, it's not. Well, I know, I guess I know a little bit of it. My dad used to talk about these cars and what a big impression they make when they first came out. But then he also liked to talk about how he had a Chevy Vega at the time, and he used to like to blow the doors off of people who had these cars. But
right, because these are what? Low 100s?
150.
150?
This one was listed at 150.
Which actually is not too bad. I mean, you know, it's probably a car that's in the 7s or 8s, 0 to 60, I'm guessing. But,
And what he said, in terms of the impression he made, he was always talking about how it was like, you know,
it was a handling car, right?
It was a handling car, but it looked, I mean, it had great looks, yeah. But costs, they were very cheap for what
it was.
But
it was the kind of the yeah. Toyota 86 of the era, I would say, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
More cultural significance, more.
Yeah.
And this is, well, now, let's say this is probably about as fine as an example as you'll ever see. 21,000 miles, I think, as the story goes. Somebody, it was a gift for graduating, father to son, graduation gift, dental school. The guy put it away for whatever reason, and still got some original plastic and other things. It's a beautiful green color.
Yeah, I've never seen one like this. Green color with like a, I don't know, like, what do you call it? Like a baseball glove sort of color.
Interior. Yeah, it's is that even leather? It's probably vinyl, I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
I think what struck me is when this car was for sale, it was next to, I think, a Ferrari, like, 812 super fast or something that sold for, like, $212,000. I mean, that wasn't the exact model, but it was a late model Ferrari V12 front engine car that... it just didn't seem right. And when you see a car like this, what do you think when there's a car that is such an outlier? As I understand it, this car wasn't a special model, that there were some higher horsepower models, there were some more desirable models. This is not one of those. What does this car have going for it? I mean, it's extremely low miles. It's in great shape. It's, I think, a one owner. It's got a story, but
it's a time capsule.
And you could argue a car is worth what someone would pay for it, but as my friend Ben pointed out, is there some sort of group that's trying to up the numbers on a car like this? Is there, I mean, this is just,
well,
when you look at statistics, you shouldn't get an outlier like this, right? I mean, it's so far out of the realm of.
Why don't we do this? I'll make the argument for maybe why I think it could be real, and you sort of poke holes in it, and then you make the argument, and I'll poke holes in it, but. You know, it's. I mean, it's an incredibly original. I mean, look, it does. I mean, look, 21,000 miles isn't like nothing, but so this, they're saying this wasn't restored.
As I understand,
it's original.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the one thing you hear people say is that, you know, no matter how much money you have, you can't necessarily get originality.
It's true, and you know, again, this is a world that neither of us know much about. We love cars, but I think we're fairly focused in what we're interested in.
Yeah.
Right?
And there's always extent, even if we weren't focused, there's extent to what we can and can't learn and
sure, what we do and sure.
Know. But like, you know, the trend on, you know, car values tends to follow sort of like the prime earning capacity.
Right.
You know, minus about 30 years or so. So
right.
Kind of like when you can't, you're making the most amount of money,
yeah.
You go back and buy the car when you were about 14 years old.
But this car's too early for that.
I'm not sure if it is.
Yeah?
Because,
okay.
I think this would be kind of in the meat of that bell curve.
I just don't ever remember this being a car that people were passionate about in a way that other cars, people were passionate about other cars.
See, I think that might be, you might be wrong on that.
But okay, well, and maybe I am because as reading this article in Hagerty, or on Hagerty.com, apparently there were 1,600 comments in the thread on this sale. 1,400, sorry, probably 1,600 now. This was written a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And there were 60 comments debating the correct color of the screws on the door card and center console. So obviously there are Datsun nerds out there. Hey, and good for them. We can't all be into Porsches, and there are probably too many of us as there is.
Well, I guess my argument is I wouldn't underestimate the mass appeal for these cars and the popularity.
But here's the thing. I've gone to a few cars and coffees in my life. Cars and coffee. It's just like attorneys general, cars and coffee. Cars and coffees, I guess, right? Okay. You know, I've got a lot of friends who are into cars. I don't know any Datsun people. I've met Studebaker people.
Well,
I've met Corvair people.
If you were to go to Southern California,
do you think that's it?
You would see all of these, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, ironically, this car couldn't be further away from Southern California.
It's in
Massachusetts.
It's in my home state of Massachusetts, Seacock, Massachusetts. I had to look it up again. I'm familiar with the town, but I didn't remember exactly where it was. My guess, and I was right. It's in the southern part of Massachusetts. Okay. It's on the border of Rhode Island.
That's where the real Massholes are, right?
Oh, God, it's strong down there. That's where the Patriots are.
So, well, be careful what you say. They're going to come beat us up. But
no, I'm one of them. They won't beat me up.
But I guess I knew never...
Not true.
I guess I never grew up in a place or lived in a place where Dotsons were particularly interesting.
Well, so I think... So, what? And here's what I'll say, for example. Like, I think they were very popular at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they were very popular, you know, when they were still relatively, you know, new used cars.
Sure.
But since they weren't very expensive, you know, they weren't necessarily like all pampered. A lot of them were driven that. So I think a lot of them actually did get like, you know, driven into the ground.
Sure.
And gone. You know, I mean,
sure.
In some ways we've said this before, like it's rare to find an old economy car these days.
Yeah.
Than it is to find
a
Ferrari or Bugatti.
Because some of the most interesting because of that.
Yeah. Because they weren't taken care of. So it's weird to find an old cheap car.
Well,
and this kind of like, this sort of, in a way, has like that same problem. And a lot of the ones that would have been sold in the Northeast, which there were a lot of at the time, mm-hmm. you know, probably rusted out.
Yeah.
So,
and is this just evidence of, you know, sort of your, what do you want to call them, A-list cars having become so popular and out of reach that we've moved on seeking other ways to...
Well, I would have thought, I guess I was a little surprised still by the value because I would have thought maybe these would have peaked a little bit a while ago.
Yeah.
But... So I come back to my argument. Let me paint a picture. There is a wealthy man who really dreamed about this.
Sure.
Like when he was 14 years old, he just wanted this car and thought it was the best.
We
remember being obsessive about certain cars. So 14-year-old. And then he finds this one, which is...
Yeah.
It's like his... It's brand new. It's like if he could have... You can't buy a time machine.
Yeah.
But you can spend an exorbitant amount of money... And buy a car that's almost like I bought it brand new.
Yeah. No, this... Yeah,
I mean, that's the only reason... There's a lot of people out there with a lot of money.
So. But this is not an exceptional performer.
I think it's about that,
It
though.
Was... Yeah. I mean, I guess... We've talked about this before. A lot of these bring a trailer auctions. It comes down to one or two people who just really want a car. And I think so much of it is nostalgia, right? I mean, talked about my first car, 1981 BMW 320i, which was... Only 11 or 12 years old at the time when I got it, but it seemed ancient, you know, and a 10, 12-year-old car now just doesn't seem like anything.
No, within
the realm of normal or
somehow,
whatever. But
I somehow think like a 2007 car is like a
practical. No, well, right, that was like 2 years ago, right? But but I've seen some now, these 320s, this is maybe a parallel. This is a car that actually had less horsepower, I think, depending on the year, between about 101 and 100 and I think 11 or 115 horsepower, depending if it was the earlier carbureted version or the later fuel injected. An advantage offset by the 4 versus 5 speed manual, but that's a conversation for another time.
This what was color were the bolts on the door car?
Rust.
the correct color. Okay.
But this is a car that, I mean, I bought mine for about $2,000 when I think I sold it for closer to $4,000 because I really I love this car and I made it nice. But I am seeing some of these now that I've sold for $30,000 or more. And again, this is a car that I'm sure it was slower than this Datsun.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not a whole lot more. It didn't cost a whole lot more when they were new. Not particularly valuable or desirable at the time. They were the low man on the BMW totem pole. Mm-hmm. And so it can't be anything but nostalgia, right? And so, you know, to your point, maybe that's all it takes.
Well, it takes at least... two people who really feel like they want to have that experience again.
That's it.
And you can't go back in time.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I'll have to go back and look at the actual bidding war, how many people were involved. I mean, I just, you know, aren't there algorithms to determine like when bidding is fake? And I mean, there are ways we could probably figure this out.
Maybe.
Maybe,
I don't know. I don't necessarily know what that is.
Are we upset about this just because,
like, we're looking at the data here on the graph. It is definitely the definition of an outlier.
Yeah, yeah.
What's this next one here?
And again, a car is worth what someone will pay for it, right?
Yeah.
How many pristine, low mileage, late model Corvettes are sitting in people's garages, you know, and they're, you know, the owners are certain that they're worth, you know, X amount of dollars, but there are so many of them, they're not. it's something like this that is scarce or rare, you know. I mean, maybe that's enough. That and the nostalgia take over the time. But for $310,000, I could build out a complete dream garage for $310,000, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, when we're talking, you know, you can buy a... I mean, Porsches are coming down. I mean, you can get a... I don't know. You look at a Porsche 912, which can't be any slower. Maybe it is. But, you know, and I'm seeing really good examples for $40,000 right now. And I know they're kind of slow and they're not a 911 and this and that, but would you rather have this Datsun or 8 or 10 Porsche 912s in similar condition?
I don't know if I need that many 912s.
Well, but, you know, it's...
But, I mean, for that amount of money, I'm talking... I think we're talking a 2.7 RS, aren't we? Maybe?
I think so.
We're in that territory.
You know, the blue over white, you know, the...
Yeah, maybe one that's a little bit rougher, but like...
Yeah, I would think around $300,000, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, and someone's... I'm sure someone's screaming into their respective laptop to, that's not even close, but like, there's some high-end... I mean, all right, how about this?
Jerry Seinfeld, if you're listening, I know that...
If you can, you know, chime in on this, that'd be great.
You've owned at least Spike one of these, yeah.
Or, you know, if not maybe that, then certainly a, we'll say, long hood, you know, 911S, yeah, for sure, right? Like, probably one of the nicest ones out
there. Or how about a brand new GT3 RS? Or how about a 997 GT3, a new Range Rover, and a Ferrari 360 in your garage? I mean, it's just, I don't know. It boggles my mind, but...
Yeah, like, well, all right, so... You know, I've done a little since we've been talking here. I'm looking at the next highest one.
Okay.
240Z that sold on Bring a Trailer. It was a 1970 240Z. 33,000 miles shown. This one was...
So quite similar in mileage and...
Yeah. This one's not as original, though. It did go through a full restoration process in the 90s. Received a gold medal award for that at a National Z Car Corp convention. It was displayed at the Whitney Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Well, covers featured
during induction of former Nissan Motor Corporation USA president Yutaka Katayama into the Automotive Hall of Fame in 1998, and was used as a basis for the Franklin Mint model wearing the same chassis number. So,
well, that's quite
in the world of 240Zs, that's actually like this might... I thought this would have been the most prestigious.
Absolutely.
One out there.
Yeah. Well, the Franklin Mint does carry a lot of cachet.
Well, and so as a comparison, folks, this one sold for $124,000.
Wow. Okay,
so,
now that I can... That, because
I mean, this one we would assume... But it's not as an attractive a color combination.
No, it's a weird sort of mustardy orange, if you want to call it that.
Oh, does it come with a Franklin Mint model? That'd be neat. And then more standard black.
Better come with a box of Franklin Mint models, but yeah. I don't know, maybe, again, this is just a cultural thing, a part of the country thing. Where I grew up, if it wasn't a Mustang 5.0, then maybe a BMW, you know, 318 was the cool car to have, or an M3.
I think you're right to be surprised by the value because that's eye-popping.
Yeah.
But I think you're underestimating the overall allure of these cars and the popularity with certain people. So
you're absolutely right.
These things had a very strong... these things for their time had this sort of same appeal as 911s, even in Corvettes, you know, but without, like, they don't have the continuation of that purity of that model
for as
long necessarily. They, you know, this thing kind of grew from the 240, which was a light little handling sports car, into larger and larger, you know, grand touring, turbocharged, 2+2s. They got bigger, wider, more vents, more louvers. And then they had to kind of return to sort of like, you know, to form with it.
And in a way, you know, Datsun is an orphan brand. I mean, yes, they evolved into Nissan, but, you know, I think oftentimes a car continues to grow in value when they're currently cool cars too, right?
Yeah.
Ferrari, Porsche, they've kept that legacy going.
Yeah.
You know, then you look at other cars that, you know, would have been fine cars, but they no longer exist, right? Some of the Oldsmobiles, you know, some of the Italian brands that aren't sold in the States anymore. People don't have that connection.
Sometimes I have a hard time sort of staying relevant, so the older cars...
Well, that's what it is. It's relevance, right?
So, when the new 911 comes out, there's always this, that picture where they put it on like the continuum of all the previous you know, versions of it from from the original through the to the current.
Okay, and by the way, if you're one of these people that keeps posting this, you know, what's the picture of the first generation 9/11 next to the most current generation 9/11, and of course they choose the narrowest, narrow tired early one in the widest Carrera 4S.
Well, in the original 911s, there was just the one tire size.
Well, width, I don't know. There's if you look next time, look at that. There's one picture in particular I see floating around. There's some tricks of the light in that. And the last time I saw posted, someone said, "Well, I'd be curious to know what that first 911 looks like next to a current Cayman, because the Cayman is quite a bit tidier."
Mm-hmm. But the Cayman. I mean, not to get off on a big tangent here, but it's the 911.
Yeah.
There is still a through line between the original one and the current one.
Yes.
And sort of some relevance there. But, you know, you keep hearing people saying, like, oh, like, are they going to bring a 928 back? You know? And it's like, no, they're not, because the 911 now does what the 928 was supposed to do. And if for some reason it doesn't, then the Panamera does it.
Yeah.
And there's no reason
for it. No, I know. And I would argue, too, that even the early 911s were GTs in a way, and, you know, and
well, Ferdinand. Certainly compared to the 356s they were replacing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I remember there was a quote, you know, from Ferdinand Porsche about how, you know, he intended this to be an all-around car, you know, a car you would daily drive. And so I think some of those arguments are null and void.
Yeah, I'm okay. I mean, it has gotten bigger. But it has always been more of a. Yeah, it's either a GT car that behaves like a sports car, or a sports car that you can use like a GT car. Yeah. But, I mean, it's still one of the best handling cars of all time, no matter what you classify it as.
Yeah.
But it's a bigger car now. I mean, there's no way around it. And the Cayman has kind of slotted. The Cayman and Boxers have slid in there as maybe if you want to get back to that small, tight handling, just all about sort of. You know, feel and response, if then you go into those two cars.
So, right. And we're not going to have time to talk about this today, but we have to talk about, speaking of the Cayman, the 718, the 4.0 models coming out. So I've got a lot to say about that.
Right, I've got some thoughts. We definitely have to share that, but we'll save that for another episode. But
Let's wrap up this segment. We'll be back. And
we'll be right back.
So I was watching, I guess it was YouTube the other night, as I'm wont to do, and I can't quite get to sleep, and I want to have a drink, and it's been a long day, and I fell down the rabbit hole of Doug DeMuro and some of the less good car YouTubers.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is I think Doug DeMuro is actually one of the better ones, but there are some ones that aren't so good. I'm not quite sure why they have the number of views and followers and all that, but I happened across...
Russian bots.
It must be because... there's just not, Doug DeMuro, I give him a lot of credit. He has his quirks and features. He has his thing, right? Matt Farah has his, he doesn't do this anymore, but he would drive your car, and that was interesting.
Yeah.
And
he does occasionally, but he's not doing those.
Yeah, no.
What were those,
the viewer,
the quick trip, the quick trips.
I appreciate. Yeah. I mean, but there's some others, but I just can't watch, because all they are, they're just a succession of new cars they're buying. Mm-hmm. It's clickbait anyway. But I did happen across James May has a show, and I've always been a big fan of James May, of the trio the Top Gear trio. I guess he was always the one I appreciated the most in a way, and you always like any good storyteller or protagonist or whatever, you always, I guess, you sort of identify with one, right? And he was, I guess, the one for me. And he's been involved with this thing called Drive Tribe, which I'm not too familiar with. Apparently, it's been a financial disaster, but
a little bit boondoggle.
But the one show that's got the Drive Tribe brand name on it that's actually held my interest, or that I've sort of become a fan of, is it's called James Mail's Mail Time. James May's Mail Time. And he basically just sits at a desk in front of a computer and opens up mail that people send him. And he also has a giant Oscar the Grouch style trash can right next to the desk that he can chuck things in if they don't meet his approval. And apparently a lot of these things he'll you can write in and request if you want the thing he's going to throw away, or if he's received more than one of something. And people will send him beer, which he keeps. He seems happy about. People will send him weird sort of car-related inventions. Some guy sent in these trays for storing your Matchbox or Hot Wheels cars that when you would stack them on top of each other, they would basically turn into, as James May... I've never heard this term for such a thing. He called it a helter-skelter, but it was basically sort of a spiral that the cars would go down, which was interesting. Someone sent him, signed him up for a list of flooring samples, and he opened those, and and those immediately went to death.
So he's just getting random
flooring samples. Yeah, it's really good. I want to send him something. I'm amazed that all these people randomly sending him things and spending... Have you mailed anything at a United States post office lately? Not only is it a nightmare to go into the post office, but it's crazy expensive.
It's
gotten very expensive.
But at one point I was looking at like a garage storage system, and they did send me out like a free sample of like what their laminated wood would look like.
Oh, yeah.
So I could I find that company again. I could send that to James May.
Or you just you send it in with 10,000 different names and you have a floor.
I might have a whole floor.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Yeah. This has nothing to do with anything other than I found the show entertaining and a way that only James May can be entertaining.
This is something you and I were maybe just discovering about ourselves. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of James May. My friend, my buddy Chris Hawes back in Concord, Mass, or Carlisle, Mass, is also a big fan. Hopefully he's listening right now. We were throwing James May quotes back and forth to each other.
Yeah,
he's not that big of a car guy, but he's from England, so he really appreciates James May's. So we were watching the show we found on Prime called James May's Man Lab.
He just
kind of like took it upon himself to sort of like, you know, get back into the manly pursuits of you know, building things and figuring things out. And you know, these are some quotes from the shows. Quote: "Wasps, I'm afraid, are one of the creator's errors," which is, and then he goes on to say, "along with Belgium," which just made me laugh.
In Belgium is kind of a mess. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Sorry to our Belgian audience, but yeah.
I know they make fine chocolates and
waffles.
Waffles, but a lot of the Belgium I've seen is just sort of like the south side of Chicago, honestly.
Oh, really?
Industrial and sort of depressing. So anyway, sorry, Belgian people.
I assumed it was just
I've heard it referred to as the armpit of Western Europe.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never been there. I always figured it would be.
I'm hoping if we insult enough people tonight, it'll really boost our ratings.
We'll lose the Belgian audience, but we'll pick up the Dutch. It'll be fine. We'll all even out. So, my favorite quote from that was when he was talking about building. Somehow he was building a pool table, and this was his quote. Quote, "Nature abhors regularity. There is no square or straight. They are only mere concepts of civilization. They are but vanities." I said that's from the Book of May, chapter 5.
Okay,
16.
Yeah, that's a deep one.
It's a deep one, but it's so absurd.
A guffaw or a chuckle. Yeah,
it's so absurd, though. I love that. So.
Well, there are no I'm gonna screw it up, but something. But basically, there are no straight lines or right angles, right, in nature.
That's what he's saying. Effectively, it goes with a lot more flourish. Yeah.
You could look at a crystal or something, and probably.
Well, he was building a pool table out of like logs.
Yeah, because
so
of course
what
he.
Like, yeah, because that's what he was doing.
That you only do that if you're James May or wildly wealthy and have a lot of time and are British, right?
Something like that. So well. Anyways, that's our shout out to James May.
We appreciate you.
Pedantic and weird and British.
Right. Speaking of weird, let's talk a little bit about electric cars.
Electric cars. Well, yeah.
Because you got me thinking about electric cars. Neither one of us have ever been a big fan. I don't really desire an electric car. Do you?
No. But I've had some revelations lately.
Yeah.
So, but I want you to share yours first, though.
Well, it's
so
interesting. We were talking about the other day, and I'm a big watch guy, and I don't know if wristwatches and specifically, I like Rolex watches and Tudor, which is sort of their budget brand historically, and now I can't claim, much like I can't claim to have a fleet of of Porsches or sports cars. I have one modest model. It's a, sort of the same way with watches. But over the years, I've owned different models. Rolexes, I have because you know, prices weren't always what they are now, and there was a time you could go on Craigslist and find a pretty good deal and flip it and make $1,000. And so so it was sort of a self-perpetuating a hobby or whatever you want to call it. But but it got me thinking really about, you know. You know, you hear about all these, everyone's so scared that electric cars are going to take over. And sure, there are issues with regulation and all that that will factor into this. But, you know, in the 70s, the big thing was the quartz watch, right? That was, and they weren't even cheap when they first came out. And they were so much more accurate than the mechanical watches, not only of then, but of now. You know, a quartz watch, meaning it's basically, and I'm going to mess this up, but it's basically an electrical circuit that beats at a certain, just by its nature, beats at a certain frequency.
Super high precision.
Right, which then, you know, can be translated into a highly accurate timepiece. It all has to do with electrical pulses and things. Mm-hmm. Versus, say, a mechanical watch, which is, you know, there are a couple different ways you can hand wind a watch. It could be an automatic that will regenerate through your movement, but basically it's all operating on gears and balances and jewels and things. And anyway, the quartz watch really was going to be the next big thing, right? And it was going to obsolete all of the mechanical watches. And while quartz watches, even back in the 70s, were being sold for thousands of dollars, people were getting rid of their mechanical watches, as I understand it, pennies on the dollar because...
So let me ask, just from like a historical perspective, to kind of relate it to what we're dealing with right now, was when this quartz watch technology was introduced, was it considered more precise than mechanical
watches? Oh, totally, 100%. Okay.
But not necessarily cheaper.
No, not at first. Not at first. And even Rolex came out. They had a model called the Oyster Quartz. And Oyster in Rolex parlance is basically that it's waterproof, right? Like, you know, shut like an oyster. Okay. Oyster Quartz. And they were very much a model of their time, very 70s looking. For years after, they really lost a lot of value. But I guess my point is, everyone thought, you know, mechanical watches were going to fall by the wayside, and it was over time. You know, quartz watches. I mean, obviously, a lot of the cheaper watches now are quartz. You know, it's got to be a few $100 watch for the most part to even get into a mechanical watch. But I guess my point is, now you can buy either one. Mm-hmm. The expensive watches, for the most part, still are automatics. Or, I'm sorry, still are mechanical watches. Many of them are automatics. I guess I see that happening with, you know, if you take regulation or, you know, take the environment and all this out of the equation, and you really just look at, you know, electric versus internal combustion cars on their merits, you know, there are room for both. I think that... You know, I mentioned that, you know, earlier we were talking, even Steve Winwood in his song Ark of a Diver talks about the accuracy of a quartz watch. I mean, it was a cultural thing. It was, you know, I mean, it was a big deal.
Pop music.
Yeah, you know, and then ultimately we discovered that really that it's about more than accuracy, right? And even now, you know.
Well, I guess that's interesting is that, yeah, up until this point, that's what all those precision watchmakers were driving for,
right?
Was to make it more and more precise.
Yes.
And then this was the thing that got them that next step forward, but...
And they realized it wasn't all about the accuracy,
some people, yeah,
right?
they lost something there.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a point, like I said, Rolex was making watches. Some of them were gold, and they were putting in these quartz movements, which at the time were expensive, but now, I mean, a quartz movement, you know, is pennies. So you could take a quartz movement and put it into a, you know, $5,000 of gold, right? But it's still a quartz watch. And I guess the analog here is, you know, you can look at a Tesla, you know, a dual motor Tesla that can do 0-60 in 2.9 seconds or whatever it is. Maybe it's faster now. You know, and can be had for, you know, $80,000 or $90,000 or $100,000. You compare it to a, you know, to get a Porsche at that level, you're looking at a turbo or a, you know, we're talking about the internal combustion.
Yeah. Well, so I think you're absolutely right. I mean, so this electric engine has given us some great benefits, and some great steps forward for us, right? I mean, you have all this torque and power, you know, less mechanical things that can go wrong, and so it offers some very obvious benefits, right? Much like the quartz watches did. But, are you going to feel strongly about that Tesla Model S in 25 years?
Yeah, and that's kind of it, right? And you know, again, if you need a car that's highly... what's the word I'm looking for? Accurate or highly... not accurate, but highly...
practical, useful.
If it's just about that...
If it's just getting performance, around,
you know, you get that exact same launch, the same each time, right?
Yeah.
It's everything is computer controlled. But...
Well, so here's my thought on it is, you know, I find that people who don't tend to like cars as much like to talk about these electric cars. Because it's like a revelation for them to have a car with that much torque.
They
feel that difference. It takes a much more expensive gas-powered car to get the same level or, you know, even as much.
Right.
So that resonates with them. But, like, people like you and I mean, we're going to miss... If all companies get away from it altogether, we're going to miss... It's not that the gas-powered car is better performing, but we like that analog feel. We like the thought of all those little parts moving around and in precision and just sort of coming together into this sort of, like, symphony, sort of, like, noise and power and feeling and stuff.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm...
And it's kind of like what the watches are. Watches, we kind of came full circle on that, and people really... I think people who are into those watches now really... Yeah. They like the movement.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm getting at. I just don't see, when you take regulation and all that out of the equation, I think I don't see electric cars replacing. I see them as just another option, right?
And yeah, except I would take it one step further, and I'm sorry to step on your toes here, but it's a slippery slope, I guess. I came over here in a Lyft tonight, and it was a Kia Niro, you know, whatever their bottom of the line hatchback
is. I hardly even know what that is.
It's just their entry level hatchback, but it was electric. And the guy pulled away from a stop sign and it just, like, you know, just took off. Yeah. You know what I mean? I don't care. The gas powered equivalent of that car, I never cared about. I don't care about. And I don't care if that car gets replaced with all electric.
Yeah.
I don't care if all the UPS trucks are replaced with electric or all the loud diesel trucks that. You have to listen to in the city or replaced by electric.
Trains would make sense.
I was gonna argue. I don't think I've ever heard a powerboat that sounds good. Like, it's just a loud noise you have to deal with while you're, like, out on the water. I wouldn't mind if that sound is reduced, you know, to electric. You know.
Yeah. Well, aren't trains electric anyway? They're just diesel powered electric as they are. Like.
The big cargo freight trains are diesel electric. So it's like a diesel. Generally hybrids. Power and stuff like that. Yeah,
the hybrids. Did you know that? Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, your subways and stuff are pure electric. Yeah, absolutely. So,
but those are different too because they don't carry batteries. It's all dependent on the grid. Yeah.
Yeah. But there was this town in Australia that replaced. They have a train that goes back and forth between like a beach and like the downtown of the area, all solar powered. You know,
really?
So it's all on board and they do it all on that. But
yeah.
I don't mind if all those engines go away. I don't need to
I know. It's
a Mitsubishi 4-cylinder economy engine anymore.
No, that's a good...
But I don't want the resources to go away for people developing those high-performance, what we would consider jewel-like internal combustion
engines. Well, and that's kind of it, right? If you want to go out and get a Casio digital watch, I mean, that would be the equivalent of a Nissan Versa, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean... It's just about something
on your arm that you.
That's sort of how I see this, what will be the downfall of internal combustion cars if it's not regulation? It'll be people just don't want to buy them, right? And I guess I just don't see that.
The problem is that it doesn't have to be everybody doesn't want them. But there could be a tipping point where enough people. Don't care that manufacturers don't put the time and effort into it anymore. And so I feel like there's maybe one scenario where we get like a few boutique firms still making them, but they're hard to get maintenance. They're hard to get serviced and things like that. you know, and maybe it becomes really expensive to buy gas because, you know, we switch over to all electric. But I hope there's at least some space for it still in the future. Maybe even if it is as a specialty item. I mean,
yeah.
The powerboat didn't completely replace the sailboat.
So. No, and that's another, because
it's a different experience.
It's a different experience.
Yeah. No, so I hope there's still something there for it, but yeah. I guess we'll see. We don't know, but you know, there's there is room for both. And like I said, there's a lot of things I don't care if they all go to electric, but you know.
Right.
I just want my Porsche. I haven't even got my first Porsche yet. I still want that one to be.
It's not for lack of trying on my part. How many texts and emails did I send you this week with listings? I mean, you must.
To give our audience an idea here, Ryan is really persistent and really should get a commission from Porsche if I ever buy one. He does send me. He's very nice to send me at least 2 to 3 listings a day. I'd say on average.
I gotta keep it fresh in your mind.
It's very fresh in the mind. It's just not fresh in my checking account or my reality.
I understand.
We're close though. We're getting there. So stay tuned. It's one of these days we're gonna have you come out and drive a few of the cars that I've been looking at.
Yeah.
And then I'll make sure I drive some of the cars you've been, you know, sort of thinking I should drive, and we'll get your thoughts on that. So.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
So I've got one more thing I want to talk about. So let's wrap this up and.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to come back to a little bonus segment here. So stay tuned. So we're back and we're going to kind of freestyle here for a little bit, take a look at some cars and bring a trailer. And I just brought this to Ryan's attention. Original owner, 1500 mile, 2011 Porsche 911 GT3 RS 4.0.
Yeah, okay.
And 11 days left on the bid here. It's already up to $355,000.
Which is crazy to me. As you know, I like me a GT3.
Yeah.
And
you may have called this particular GT3 model the best car you've ever driven.
Yeah, so but the 3.8
you'd ever need. Yeah.
So yeah. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but fundamentally, I mean, there are some differences. I think that the wing's a little different stuff, and these were obviously much more limited. This one has the bucket seats, but comparing this to a same year,
a 3.8 versus a 4.8.
Yeah, okay, yes, this is the RS, but how is this car worth many multiples what a regular GT3 would? How much more horsepower is this than the standard? If it's more than 40, I'll...
500 horsepower, 339 pounds per foot.
Okay, so it's... What is it? Is it... It's close to 100 more horsepower. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So maybe
that might make a difference.
Not much of a point. but I can't imagine that the driving experience is so fundamentally improved.
There must be something really different with the engine architecture. It's not just a displacement difference, right?
It probably is. I don't know.
Back to my point though, you called the GT3. Regular GT3, if you will. Base GT3.
Yeah.
The last car you'd ever need to drive, ever.
Yeah.
So this driving experience must be just pure nirvana. You must want to just kill yourself when you have to give the keys back.
That's right. I've never understood, I guess, why the Golf and the prices, other than just the rarity or whatever. But the regular one looks better because you don't have those, what are the little pieces on the front fenders, the little air,
splitter things,
what do they call those? I guess I've seen so many fake ones on Hondas and take something away. It's a beautiful car, but I've only driven the regular GT3. I've not driven the 4.0.
Are there GT3 4.0s non-RS?
No, no.
All these are RSs.
All those are RSs. Okay. And I don't think, was there a, no, there was a, yeah, and there was also a 3.8 RS.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, also.
There's a regular, there's just a GT3 and then a GT3 RS in the 3.8.
3.8, right.
But for the 4.0s, they're all RSs.
Right. And okay. I if I remember correctly, the 3.8 GT3 RSs aren't hugely more expensive than the regular GT3s. Definitely rare and, you know, I think a few tens of thousands of dollars more expensive. But now that's just a...
It's I mean, I guess we'd have to drive one to really see.
Well, that's so. If anyone has one, wants to let us.
But it could, you know, that the price difference could just be driven by speculation and just, you know.
I wonder. But yeah, maybe it wasn't Sharkworks boring out the 3.8s to make them 4.0, and not the real 4.0, but.
But maybe get most of the benefits of it.
Yeah, right? I don't know. It's a cool car, but I don't know if it's that cool.
So this, I just popped this listing open. It's not exactly relevant to what I'm about to say, but I just watched on YouTube. Do you ever watch Harry Metcalf's videos?
I do. Yeah. Did you see the one with the Lotus Esprit the other day?
I'm not sure if I saw that one, but the one I saw recently is that he drove an early model, like a first year, second year Diablo, rear wheel drive.
Yeah. And no, I haven't seen that one
yet. Hadn't really thought about the Lamborghini Diablos much, but that video kind of got me thinking about them again.
Yeah.
And those early rear-wheel drive before... The all-wheel drive ones came later.
Yeah.
They kind of wanted to get the new model out there, get it going. They didn't quite have the full development.
Before. Yeah.
And he was really speaking very highly about, you know, what the rear-wheel drive ones are like to drive.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again, but I want to be him when I'm 75 or whatever he is. He's living the life. I'll never forget the episode where... Was he going down to the south of France or something? Because he kept the sailboat there. And
I think he has a house.
I have an SL600 or something that I forgot about. That's in this parking lot that's been under this tarp for 6 months.
That's his life.
He's former editor of Evo magazine, which is really one
founder,
of the best.
Creator that's how he made his fortune. I guess
I will say I do. There's something about he's not maybe not as critical about things as you or I would be. I guess again, when you have a certain amount of wealth or whatever, it's just these things become just more and more of a commodity. It's evidenced by the way he treats some of these cars like regular cars.
He does, yeah. He kind of just drives them around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he
takes his Testarossa and like huge rallies to the north of Africa.
Yeah, didn't he? He took an early Lotus Esprit. One owner, you know, 30,000 miles. He took it to some alpine ski resort in Germany to see his
Land Rover see that one because
Defender,
he had a Spectre from the movie
Bond
car that was apparently could never get licensed for the road.
Yeah,
and he got tired of it, so he sold it. But then he got nostalgic for it, and so he took his brand new, or to him brand new Esprit, which you're right, which is like
and
a low mileage one.
Snows.
Yeah. Put snow tires on it and drove to a mountaintop in Austria to go look at his old car.
Yeah, and they got there, and he's usually not one to get like emotionally wrapped up in a car.
Yeah.
But he saw this thing, and like people had climbed all over it to take pictures. Yeah. The fender liners or the fender extensions were missing.
Yeah, you could
tell he was really pissed, but the current owner had been pretty good to him and let him come, and you know, so he didn't want to show up, but you could tell he did not approve. And I admire him because he drove this Lotus down. I mean, I'd have a tough time driving, you know, my car up to the mountains with snow tires. I just, you know, first of all, I wouldn't want to put snow tires on it because I wouldn't want to take the wheels off and risk marring the the wheels.
Scratching them unnecessarily.
Right, you know, and he's obviously worked through that or, you know, is beyond that. And, you know, he's just the kind of guy, he'll just... You know, he'll open up the trunk of a car and, you know, he'll shove in his luggage and the zippers are scratching against the paint. And it makes me cringe. But I also envy the man for having that sort of freedom with his cars, whatever, and really using them what they're, is what they are. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to your point about the Diablo. was it a black Diablo? I think I saw it, and it was
either black or like kind of like a purplish amethyst sort of.
I still remember my first Diablo. I've never driven a Diablo, but first time I saw one, it was one of the purple, the anniversary editions.
I'll remember
that forever because it was just it was so out of place when I saw it, and just the last thing I expected to see that day.
I used to have I don't know where it got lost in one of my moves, but I used to have a diecast model of that.
Was that the
35th anniversary edition. It was, purple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is just a reminder, if you haven't seen the vintage 60 Minutes segment where they go to the Lamborghini factory, it's good stuff.
Look it up. It's on YouTube.
Right. With the test driver, what's his
Young Valentino Balboni.
Yeah, who's still doing the same thing all these years later. Yeah, pretty good piece.
Well, but, and it's a two-part. You can go watch the original one,
okay,
where like Morley Schaefer is like driving around in a Countach.
Yeah,
they did kind of as an anniversary sort of edition, maybe okay, 2 or 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
They went back and did it again, yeah, and that time he's driving around in a Ventador, you know, an open-topped Ventador.
Okay,
so
yeah, I need to see. I know of that, but I don't know that I've seen it. I need to watch that.
And it's fun to watch them,
but
both, so.
Yeah, Diablos were never. If you ever looked at one close up, they're kind of kit car-ish, more so than other Lamborghinis.
So yeah, so the development of the car started prior to the Chrysler ownership.
Well, that had,
and,
yeah,
and well, it, in a way, it's. There's some quality issues throughout the whole process, basically until Audi gets a hold of them. Until you know the last of the Diablo line, it's under Volkswagen, you know, management at that point.
So
I think the quality of the interior fit and finish and some of the stuff comes up, but it was still like a, I don't know, it was still a revelation of a car when it came out though.
Yeah,
it was a hard act to follow.
Yeah,
coming after the iconic Countach, but like, I just remember being obsessed with the fact that it could go over 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah. And
it was a big deal.
Yeah, it was, you know, and of course, gated manual shifter and mm-hmm, all that. And to be honest, I remember the first time I saw a Countach, too, I was a little disappointed in the fit and finish. I don't know. The Diablo was I think that's what it was, right? It was the whole Never Meet Your Heroes thing. It was such an iconic car from my youth. You know, a car that, you know, I think maybe I ever saw once, you know, as a kid, and that purple one, and to really get up close one later, I don't know, it just didn't. Porsche people are weird, right? Like, Porsche people compared to Italian car people aren't willing to put up with some of the same things, right? I think that's a fair. Porsche people are all about the paint meter readings and all that, and I feel like the Ferrari people, I mean, the car just doesn't come out perfect, so
it's never perfect.
And then you sort of and that's it, right? It doesn't stop them from trying to make it perfect, but
well, maybe that's the difference. I often wonder sometimes, what's the difference specifically about, it has a little bit to do with cost, but what's specifically the difference between this Ferrari and Porsche? Because here's why they're the same.
Okay,
they're primarily focused on sports cars.
Yeah,
they have both have a, you know, a laudable racing heritage winning constantly. I mean, the you know, the cars are winning on the racetrack, and that technology directly trickles down to the car you can buy. But there really isn't, considering that they're that much in common, I really can't think of two cars that are companies that are very different.
Well, two of the three have made tractors.
I
guess Ferrari. Yeah.
No, I don't know if Ferrari ever did. Never did.
Lamborghini and Porsche.
No, but I'm talking about Ferrari and Porsche specifically.
It's the difference.
Lamborghini is over here.
They don't have any between really Ferrari and Porsche. You know, I guess it's sort of the difference between a German and an Italian, right? I mean, it's just, look at...
Which nation are we going to
one country is very orderly and clean and sort of, I don't know, it's I'm generalizing.
Well, all right, but I mean, like, there's something to that, though. I mean, although I feel like Ferrari of the last 10 years, maybe 15 years, though, has made tremendous gains in sort of this idea of, like, you know, the road cars are kind of, you know, good enough,
right?
You know, and the focus was really on just winning at the racetrack, and the road cars were, you know, whatever. I mean, the road cars now, I mean, there's a level of technology and precision that's involved with them. You know, they're relatively high strung and they're expensive to fix when something goes wrong, but, like, you know, they're worlds away in terms of reliability to where they were. But, like, I feel like the Porsche is almost like, has some sort of version of, like, just obsession with just, you know, it's not just perfection, but, like, perfection in driving. Like,
yeah.
It's just, like, it's just a constant evolution, like, sort of, like,
right,
trying to drive closer and closer to get to that, you know?
Right. Well, people say, too, you know, Porsche drivers generally drive their cars, and Ferraris, you know,
well, and
polished.
And Porsche designs a car so that, as a result, like, so you can drive it.
Well, that's it, right? Yeah. You know, I've owned two Porsches. I've never been stranded. I've never had an issue. I've never had anything weird happen, like paint flaking off or... Now, the buttons...
yeah, some of the other, but no, they make some mistakes.
Yeah, but there, so does Ferrari, right? I mean, those are even worse. The gummy buttons or whatever.
The gummy buttons and the ones that caught. I mean, there's a lot of them that caught on fire.
Well, there's that. And of course, Porsche have had their low points too. IMS bearings.
And
coolant lines, and you know. Yeah. But
every time I look at those, every time I look at that sort of early 996s and late and the early Boxers, and you look at the interiors,
that
was definitely like. They were definitely like struggling at that point to kind of keep the cost
down. Yeah, no, for sure.
But
I mean,
but they still drive well though. You still see 996s with high mileage.
I mean, I've never owned a Ferrari, but I do think they're two different audiences. Yeah. I think that Porsche people, like I alluded to before, I mean, I think Porsche people want to drive. Ferrari people, I think there's more to it for them. Than that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something about that. That Ferrari, like, if you get one of those, like, high-end, you know, like, the Stradalis and the track-focused, you know, Ferraris that they make. I don't know why I went to Stradale first, but you know what I'm talking about. Uh-huh. Like, sort of like the Pistas. And
sure,
the, you know, those things are as competent as a GT3 on the track.
Yeah.
But a majority of them aren't ever used that way.
Yeah,
speculators buy them and they like hide them away.
Yeah. Whereas,
like, if someone buys a GT3, there's a high probability that that person goes out and drives it hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Porsche is certainly more accessible.
And it's a cost thing, I guess.
It's a cost thing, but it's also, I think, an attitude thing. You know, but I don't know that it was always. I mean, I don't think Ferraris were always as expensive in their time as they are now.
It's almost so it's interesting because I you know, as I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, well, what would an $80,000 Ferrari look like if they decided that they probably will never do this because they
like modern Dino.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like they want it. They keep their numbers lower than they could sell more than they do, so they won't ever do this. But what if they wanted to build an $80,000 to $95,000 car?
Yeah.
Like, is it like the Dino?
Yeah. Yeah.
What would that look like today? I mean, could they do it? Would they?
I think there's been talk of it. You know, maybe a 6-cylinder car. You know, that's what the Dino was, of course.
Mid-engine, a 2-seater.
Yeah, I've heard the Alfa 4C referred to as sort of the, what a Dino, a modern Dino would be. But I don't know. It's an interesting question. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe if they had an $80,000 model, I'd actually, someday, consider it. But
it's an intriguing idea. However, as I'm sitting here thinking, but now is the worst thing in the world buying a 10-year-old former $80,000 Ferrari?
Yes.
Because the person just barely was able to afford it, but they definitely can't.
Thing. If you want to buy a Porsche. There are $3,000 and $4,000 Porsches out there. Now we're talking about maybe a 924 or something. There are no $3,000 or $4,000 Ferraris out there, right?
Like, no. Even burnt out hulks of Ferraris are more than $3,000.
Yeah, an $80,000 Ferrari would be an interesting thing, and what was your original question? It was.
Well, I guess my original question is really, what's the fundamental difference between Porsche and Ferrari? Because they're on paper, they should have a lot more in common, but they really don't. So.
Yeah, I think the question really isn't what's the difference between the cars, what's the difference between the buyers?
Yeah, no, that's true. Well, the buyers reflect the product, but it's just they should have more in common than they do.
Yeah. You know? We know Ferrari people. We should get some of them on and ask them these questions. We should have Porsche versus Ferrari.
Porsche
debate.
Versus Ferrari. That's the new movies.
Porsche
versus Ferrari. All
right. Who wears more branded clothing?
Ooh.
Here's that. I would wear a Porsche shirt. I have worn a Porsche shirt.
Who's more likely to not have socks on and loafers?
Yeah. Well, there's just so much that goes along with it, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Like, I'm okay telling people I'm a Porsche guy, even if I own a Ferrari.
That's what I'm really focusing on. Yeah. Is that, like, saying you're into Porsches says something completely different. No one ever says I'm really into Ferraris, but people want a Ferrari because it shows, like, I have a lot of money or I'm, like, very, like, you know, successful.
I would also argue, though, that a modern Porsche owner is not so different from a vintage Porsche owner. And I think that a vintage Ferrari guy and a modern Ferrari guy are very different people.
That's a good point, too. So,
anyway, yeah. All right, we're going to have some Ferrari guys on. And
we're going to start a war here with some Ferrari guys. Yeah, so.
All right, until next time.
Yeah, thank you for listening. And if you like what you hear here, please rate and subscribe us. We really appreciate it.
It all helps.
It helps.